Welcome to the keynote stage. So my name is Mark Walsh. I'm the founder of this conference and part of the leadership team with Daniela and Manel. We have got quite a feast, quite a treat in store for you. The main stage doesn't have all the top names on. Some of them are spread out for various logistical reasons, but there are some awesome presenters on this stage. This stage is also sponsored by Alain Stefani. When we first had the idea of getting sponsors, I basically said, I won't take anyone as a sponsor unless I love what they do, because otherwise it doesn't have any integrity for me. I didn't know who Alain Stefani was, but I met her in Berlin. Someone said, oh, she's an intimacy teacher, she's an ex-sex worker, best-selling author in Germany. And I said, okay, well, I'll meet her. And I met her. And as soon as I met her, I felt at ease. I felt like, wow, this is a person who's playful, but also a deep listener. This is a woman who's a real leader. Since I've seen her work with people in very, you know, around trauma, around intimacy, around very difficult areas, men and women, I've come to regard her as a friend, actually. Like, I love her. So go to her website and check it out. It's Alain, I-L-A-N, Stefani, S-T-E-P-H-A-N for November, I. AlainStefani.com. There's an offer there called Love and Rage, which is as juicy as it sounds. You'll also find links in the descriptions for the videos below. Okay, welcome to the Embodiment Conference main stage, hosted by me, Mark, and of course, Daniela. Today we have a treat, Dr. Stephen Porges, Mr. Polyvagal Theory. I think he doesn't need much introduction for people that know about trauma. He's extremely well qualified and just a lovely bloke too. We've got to know him a little bit through the conference and one day sessions, and I very much enjoy that Stephen practices in person what his theories talk about in theory, and that's a big deal. So Stephen, you are very, very welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's really a pleasure to be here and to kind of play with you with the concept of embodiment as a interesting personal and also interactive journey. So thank you for having me here.
You're very welcome. We've got this down as an interview. So is that your understanding as well, Stephen? I just want to check.
It is mine, and I will tell you why. I'd much rather do an interview than a presentation, because an interview creates connectedness. A presentation is in many ways dissociative, or disembodiment. And I really enjoy interviews because they're spontaneous. I get to know people like you better, and I get to connect with people who are watching. So if there's a choice, take the choice of interacting with others, because we are a connected species.
Right. It feels more aligned with your work than just talking at people from afar for an hour, right? To actually have a relationship and a conversation.
Yeah, it's in a sense, one is pleasant and the other is work. So I gravitate to the pleasant one, which is actually even more on a journey of discovery than presentation, which has its pragmatic, pedantic features, which I'd rather not express.
Yeah, maybe we can go right to sort of the reality of where we are then. So we're on Zoom right now. And one thing I've noticed hosting various trauma teachers is often there's almost a sense of scarcity from people watching, like a sense of, I have to get my questions answered. And of course, we will try and answer questions. Please do put your questions and vote in them. I'll try and be fair about asking some of those to Stephen. But there's this strange feeling sometimes of sort of rush or scarcity, or if it's an hour, people say it should have been longer. If it was 90 minutes, they say it should have been 2 hours. That might be a place to start, as that's kind of the reality of where we're at here.
Yeah, I think what you're dealing with is really the fears of others. People want to have a voice. So when we say someone is fearful or under threat, what we're also saying is their body, their concept of who they are, they want a voice. And to have your question answered gives you a voice. And I've actually watched this happen with emails, where people will, in a sense, just spontaneously send me an email. And then if I respond, they'll be totally shocked that I responded. Although the emails were so, let's say, divulging, and the person was so accessible, the email, that you had to, from my perspective, respect who they were and what they were feeling. The interesting part is the brief acknowledgement, the 3 to 10 word reaction, can be transformative to the person who is asking that question. They feel heard. So the important part is these dimensions of connectedness. And one is to ask questions, because it in general forces a reciprocal behavior. But the platform of lecture and question and answer, let's say you lecture for 50 minutes and you have 10 minutes of questions and answers, is not the same as having it reversed, that you throw out some points and then you deal with the dialogue, and where you are now sharing an experience, a thought process, a feeling with another.
So I think this could be a very current way in to the heart of your work, as I understand it, is Zoom, is that people can't touch each other. They can't make eye contact or see each other. You know, right now I'm looking at the camera rather than actually at you, which would be the monitor here, you know, to create some sense of that. And many people find themselves in this situation in their work lives, maybe with family members. And, you know, one thing we noticed is when we moved from Zoom meetings to Zoom webinars, immediately we got more aggressive comments, not from everyone, of course, but just from a proportion, because there was less of that being seen, yeah, connection. So is that a way into some of the basics of your work to make a foundation here?
I think it's a way in, because the segue is the reciprocity, the speaking, the listening, the dyadic action, which is really our pathway into shared experiences and connecting with another. And within polyvagal theory, it's in regulating each other's state or physiological state. And so if we go back or rewind to, we were talking about people feeling that they don't have enough time to get their questions answered, they're saying the reciprocity has been violated. Right. Their expectancy of a response has been cut off. And now their body is saying they don't exist. They are marginalized.
And it strikes me that we're almost wired for, you know, when we're maybe 100 of us in a cave or in some trees or something, that's quite different than on the internet, where there might be 1,000 people emailing a single.
Well, I would say within your platforms, there certainly are many people. But, and again, if we're going to people, I would say we, when I give talks, I like there to be an audience. I like there to be people, because the feedback of people watching you and having facial expressions and nodding is a powerful cue to my nervous system for connectedness, as opposed to an audience that is drifting off looking at their cell phone or falling asleep. Remember, I'm an academic, and one thing that, you know, this is a true story. I never understood why many departments had their invited speakers coming in at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. So, and then where half the audience would be, you know, nodding off. I think they were always trying to create challenges for the people they were inviting in. So in a sense, I always like to say that if you're an academic, if you're in that world, you're under a state of evaluation 24/7. But evaluation to our nervous system is threat. So when we talk about assessments and tests and evaluations of grants or papers, we're really saying our body is vulnerable to being hurt. And we have to, in a sense, understand the reverse of that is, how do we enable our bodies to feel good? Well, we have this interesting evolutionary system of interacting with people that makes our bodies feel good. We feel safe with others.
That seems the core of your work, this idea of co-regulation at some point.
Yeah, I'd like to go even further with this. Yeah, I think the feature of being a mammal, and especially being a human, is this capacity, if not need, to co-regulate, which means to calm others and to be calmed by others, or to just communicate, share cues. But along this journey of being a human being, we kind of interact with people who I would call super co-regulators. And when we meet those people who are super co-regulators, all our defenses disappear. We become accessible human beings. Our core becomes available. And I actually think that's the underlying metaphor for embodiment. That when we talk about embodiment, we are in our body, but we're more than just in our body. Our body now is becoming available to interact with other people's bodies. So we are now co-regulating. And these super co-regulators, we meet them and suddenly we feel like this. We're open. Our core is there to express itself. But remember, how are human beings, let's say, shaped or controlled by society? And that is to protect their core, not to divulge who they are, to, quote, play it safe. But playing it safe is not necessarily the script to playing it as a human or playing it in a health-wise way. Our bodies want to trust. Our bodies want to share. Our bodies want to connect. Not with everyone. I'm not saying this is we go out into the world and we give everyone hugs. But to say that we evaluate, and this is where polyvagal theory talks about the social engagement system, which is really the system of evaluating at a distance, whether you want, or a psychological space, whether you feel safe with that person. So like you and I, we've never physically met, but we've had our psychological space has been minimized through our repeated conversations. So we feel is as safe with each other and not in any sense vulnerable.
Yeah, I found myself relaxing with you as soon as I met you. So it's like, okay, this person has some skills here. This, we should get you a spandex super co-regulator outfit, I think, you know, with a C on the front.
But wait till you really meet the super ones. I'm just good enough, okay? There are super ones out there. And the metaphor I used is that if that person was standing on a razor's edge, there'd be room for lots of others to join them. In a sense, they would, in a sense, their presence makes space for others.
And some of this is familiarity, right? Like we've just seen each other's faces a few times, or sometimes people will come up to me, they'll say, oh, I've seen your videos, and they'll obviously be more at ease with me than I am with them just because they've seen the face a few times.
Kind of thing. Assuming that your face was giving them cues of being welcomed. I mean, there are faces that turn people off. It's really, again, it's remarkable. I have a story like that, and that was I was giving a talk at the QE2. What is the auditorium in London? Queen Elizabeth.
The QE boat.
Not the boat. The auditorium.
Albert Hall.
There's an auditorium near Westminster that is a real large one. I was giving a talk there, and a woman rolls up to me in a wheelchair. And across the, it was out in the lobby, and across the lobby, she's staring at me. And she gets right up to me, and she says, you didn't say hello to me. I looked at her, and I said, I'm very sorry. Have we met? She said, no, I've watched you on your YouTubes. And this is the point you're making. She felt comfortable with me from the YouTube. And I was familiar to her. To me, she was some person coming up to me and saying, why didn't you say hello to me? But it was really showing you how, a polyvagal concept, neuroception works. The cues from my YouTubes, my voice, my gestures, were inviting to her. She felt accessible in my presence, so accessible that she came up to say hello.
It might be the O2 people are saying in the chat, if that was the place. And there's some cultural stuff here as well, isn't there, Stephen? Like the first time I taught in Russia, I was quite surprised by there was sort of blanker faces. And if I made a joke, people would laugh and people were perfectly friendly to me. I was very well treated, but there seemed to be a different sort of responsiveness to that, those kind of.
So the example I use is not a Russian example, but Finnish.
Okay.
And of course the Finns, one might say, they are slow to warm. But let's really put in, I'll give you my experience. I've been invited a few times and I was, you know, had really nice interactions. They were a little on the formal side. And then this very renowned scientist who I had known for over a decade, he invites me and his students to a restaurant. And the restaurant, they had a special room for us. And suddenly his personality is different. He takes off his glasses. He comes over and gets a picture with me. He gives me his book. I really start to think about that as a metaphor, using as a metaphor, a sauna culture. If you're safe enough to take your clothes off in front of other people, you're safe enough, you trust them. And this enclosed room was really part of an extended Finnish sauna culture. The same thing happened when I was a external examiner for someone's PhD in Finland. And after the examination, they had a party And the party was totally bound. The boundaries were all gone that were, in a sense, during the day. And it, to me, it was really startling because in the US, our boundaries aren't as defined as they are in Finland or perhaps Russia. But when we go to a party, there's still boundaries. And what I was really saying is that if you trust someone in these countries, the behavior is very different. In the US, it's kind of like in the middle all the time.
Right, and there are cultural differences, and some people in the comments are referring to sort of cultural trauma where there are sort of breakdowns in co-regulation as a cultural norm almost.
Yeah, I think when we start looking at the history of Western civilization, we realize that there's been a lot of, I'd say, war, destabilization, persecution, lots of trauma embedded in it, in a sense, man-made traumas. And they're all about affiliation. So they're all about, they're frequently about affiliation, whether it's religious affiliation, racial affiliation, nationality. I mean, we're talking about this in the politics of today. We're talking about this as tribalism. But it's really saying, are you part of my family or not? It's not even that. It's really saying, can I trust you or not? It's as simple as that. And if you can't trust people, your body shift state and your understanding of them shifts. You become biased to seeing them more negatively. And there is a neurophysiological adaptive value to seeing people on a negative perspective. That is, you're more likely to detect a behavior that might be injurious to you.
Right.
Your body goes into that state, but it's double-edged. You're now protecting from the danger, but you're not allowing the co-regulation, the love and trust to come in. And since you've had many people in the area of trauma speak, they will also agree or talk about the fact that when people have severe trauma, their bodies are retuned to be adaptively defensive. Yet the intention of a person who has survived trauma is to be safe in the arms of another, to feel that safety and for their bodies to conform. Yet for many of them, being held or being given a hug is such a concrete threat that their bodies recoil.
Well, thank you. I've heard a word a couple of times in this talk from you so far of trust. And I've also heard other trauma therapists on the conference say, trauma smashes people's sense of safety or rewires them to a sense of unsafety.
I think from the decades I've been working in the field of trauma, I would say it has taught me more of what it is to be a human than the decades and the many more decades that I spent studying behavior and physiology. Because with trauma, we've retuned to be defensive and we've lost the privileges. They're actually privileges of being safe enough with other people. There's another point. I think safety is one of the important features, but I think if trauma had a arsenal, it would fire first at purpose in life.
Purpose in life. Wow. Same.
Yeah. So in a sense, so when we say I'm no longer safe, there's also collateral damage, and that is, do I want to get up in the morning? Do I enjoy discovery? Do I have purpose in life? So trauma is a powerful disintegrator or damage force against purpose. And remember how many people who do not, in a sense, embody trauma in their own experiences, they respond to people who have had trauma and say, hey, what's the matter? Why are you not actively going out there? You're a young person, you're attractive, you're smart, you're this, go out there, because they don't understand the retuning to the entire nervous system, which is a system of defense now. And in doing that, purpose is removed because there is only one purpose, survival.
Mm. The thing I most notice, I think, as a manager of a team, half of which come from traumatized countries like Russia, Israel, or like Daniela and myself have done humanitarian work in war zones, is the half of us who have had that background perceive threat much more easily. They'll see your feedback as a criticism, or they'll be more cautious because they see something as threatening, or and that or perhaps like me, go a bit counterphobic and just sort of, you know, go a bit, you know, yeah, I'll borrow £1 million. But it does seem to be like that perception of threat could be quite limiting to what job you get, or do you ask someone on a date or anything?
Well, you can reframe it in terms of boldness or desire to explore. But really what we're saying is that we're limiting our life experiences because our nervous system is really doing its job. But in this case, its job is to keep you from taking any risks. Within polyvagal theory, that neuroception of risk can be so attuned that we actually are having what I call faulty neuroception. We see danger where there is no danger. And that's really where you're getting at, that if my experiences are so risk-laden, then anything that is novel in itself is now going to be a trigger of risk for me.
Great. Do you mind if I just engage the audience for a moment, Stephen, here? I sometimes feel like people, like just like all of you out there, hello, first of all. I see a lot of people have come in since the start. And how are you doing? If you want to move and breathe, don't feel like you have to sit there. I know with trauma talks and interviews like this, people can often freeze up, stop breathing. So do keep moving if you want. And yeah, do you relate to any of this? Is this resonating with people? Be nice to sort of get some sense of how we're doing here. And I'm also looking at the questions. I might segue into some of the questions from the audience, Stephen, in a moment.
Sure. I don't mind. You can even, I notice you're breaking gaze to look at the monitor, but that's okay.
So I'm very supported here. There's a tech team who will point at the camera because I keep looking at the screen. That's cool. And also I've got a couple of friends here and I can look at them and feel sort of warm and supported there's 1,000 people.
Oh, you have a throne. I like the throne.
This is extremely comfortable. Damien provided it. Thank you, Damien. It's not more interesting. Okay. So is there anything before we go into sort of questions from participants, just in terms of laying a foundation of your work here, Stephen, that would be good to kind of lay out as a foundational concept?
No, anything. We just go with the flow.
Let's go with the flow. Okay. So I'm just going to have a quick look at the chat to see how people are doing. Okay. Okay. Thank you for the comments. Basics, please, someone's saying. Newbies want a little bit of foundation. Okay, cool. So there's a question here that's very popular. Can you guide us through a little practice live that can help our vagus nerve, something brief and easy?
Well, Mark and I are doing one. We're interacting with each other. We're having reciprocity. But the exercise that you can do, because really what you're saying is there are times in your day where your autonomic nervous system is destabilizing and you're losing your sense of resource. The most potent and easily accessible method is through breath. And really what happens is when we exhale slowly, the vagal influence, the ventral vagal influence on our heart is increased. And when we inhale slowly, we turn it off. So we now know that there are two mechanisms we can use to change our autonomic state. One is increasing exhalation, which will be calming. And the other one is increasing inhalation, which will be energizing. But remember, energizing sometimes leads to anxiety and a little bit of panic. So that a lot of people who are anxious are actually huffing and only saying one word or two on their breath. The exercise that I often have people do is actually extend the duration of their phrases. Just stick more words into their phrase before they take a breath. And it will be amazingly calming. So the mechanism is when we exhale, the vagus is functional. When we inhale, it gets kind of dampened or withdrawn. If we breathe with the abdominal muscles pushing down our abdomen, it actually will amplify that vagal influence when we exhale. So doing a deep inhalation, pushing our abdomen down, and then very slowly exhaling will calm us down.
Thank you. So often I hear in yoga to elongate the out breath, and what you're saying is actually adding more words into one's phrasing. Do that.
Or the other one is play a wind instrument. You have no choice. So, which is where I came from, because I was a clarinetist when I was young. And actually, that was my state regulator, was playing music, because that's what you had to do. The other part of what I learned when I do these little exercises and workshops is what the people doing the exercises report. They report that if they extend the duration of their inhalation, so they inhale longer and short inhalation, they see the person across from them, the observer of their task, as being very evaluative of them. And they start thinking, did I do something wrong? Am I not breathing it correctly? If they reverse with a more rapid inhalation and a slow exhalation, they start thinking, oh, what an attractive person. I'd like to get to know that person. So it really is a remarkable slight modulation, which is your accessibility and your desire to be accessible to another.
So you mentioned earlier something that resonated with me, that you said evaluation is perceived as threat.
Yeah.
Any tips for people when they find themselves being evaluated, maybe on the internet, maybe an exam?
Well, let's start about it. And before we give tips, let's talk about it as a cultural feature. So when you go to a physician, what are you going to a physician for? They're going to do evaluations. Are people often anxious when they go to see physicians? Certainly. Because they're not in the medical practice is not about a shared journey of learning about your body or a shared journey of becoming healthy. It's about evaluation, which means something is wrong and someone needs to do something to you, whether it's surgical or pharmaceutical. It's still as if we're being punished for being who we are. And that's what our body is responding to. In education, it's always testing. And everyone who's, at least in our Western societies, have gone through school systems in which tests have been the markers. And we survived that. Some of us have advanced degrees, which meant that we really survived them. But I will tell you, they're not fun. They never were meant to be fun. But they are strategies of shifting our physiological state. And the paradox is, in the academic world, the shift in our physiological state from safety to threat interferes with our creativity and functionally our cognitive performance. So that if we had shifted it to a more shared journey of knowledge about what we know, as opposed to you fail or you pass, which is totally evaluative, our journey of knowledge or learning would be different. And if we rewarded people to be bold and curious, I mean, think of the problems that could be solved, as opposed to people not willing to even ask certain questions because their peers may think they're not good questions.
It strikes me this sort of online environment can feel very evaluative. You know, I know social media, Instagram, these kind of things can feel constant judge. I'm liking you, I'm not liking you.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I'm going to use an evaluative word. I think it's horrible because it's not only people are able to evaluate without being present in the experience or the context of the other. So there's no accountability. It is so they can be hurtful and have, in a sense, obtain power by being hurtful of others. And I find this a pathology that is fed by these types of platforms. And that is anonymous statements without accountability. And that's not how our nervous system evolved to function. So it wasn't that criticisms or evaluations should be off the table, but they should be there within the context and with the credibility of the person making those statements.
Right. I've had to develop firmer boundaries over the last just month, just to stay sane, I would say. And I find it can be quite painful, the evaluation, and sometimes going, well, is this person qualified? Is this person got my interests at heart? I think they're two very good questions for this kind of thing.
Yeah, but you're really saying something is that part of your body says, I don't care if they're qualified or not. Their statements are hurting me, and why would anyone want to hurt me? Especially if your intentions are to do something good. And then you get into this whole bit, and what I'm really saying is, people who are doing that are getting a sense of definement. They're defining themselves as having some power.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, it's sad, because that's not how humans are supposed to be. So I'm really agreeing with you and saying these platforms create vulnerability, and yet they're being justified by freedom of speech models that anyone can say anything. But there's a difference between saying things that people can respond to and modify versus saying things that are hurtful.
Yeah, a big shout out to Alina and Agatha, our customer support people, and also Rosie, our social media person, who are very much on the sort of emotional front line of this on a daily basis. So going to give them some love, and please be nice to them. You can disagree, you can say whatever you want, but please be nice to them.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got a great question here, which sort of follows on from something you were saying earlier. What makes a super co-regulator, Stephen? What if you're in the middle? I want to know what super looks like.
We're really saying that people have accessibility to their social engagement system, to intonation of voice, facial expressivity, all the time or most of the time. I'm working with the concept of appeasement. So this is a very interesting issue where people are, let's say, abducted, and they survive, and they survive through making their captor, their predator, feel safe with them. They're super co-regulators. They're surviving through super co-regulation of their social engagement system. And the pushback on those survivors are that they must have loved the person otherwise. But really what has happened is that they were able to convince the other person's threat biased nervous system that they were no threat. So they're alive today. And super co-regulators who are not the sense captains, but are therapists, you walk into their space and it's such a safe space that you feel good. The cues are going to be intonation of voice, facial expression, especially the upper part of the face. And they're going to also be good witnesses or witnessers. So that's another aspect of our society where we misunderstand needs of being a human. And we don't realize that we want to be witnessed. And we don't want to necessarily be told what to do or fix what we've done. So when we tell someone about our traumas or our hurts and our pains, we're not asking for that person to be empathically in pain with us. We want that person to be a compassionate witness and allowing us to express our feelings and to respect those feelings. I think we as a society and we as many of us online are therapists, I think we're confused about our roles as human beings. And I think the notion of witness, honoring another person's expression of pain and sorrow, without reaching in to try to fix it, is really something that we have to really emphasize in our training and in our own behavior. Because if we try to reach in and try to fix it, we are actually reinforcing the traumatized individual's fear that by telling you about their narrative, they are hurting you. And if they see that pain in you, that empathy, they feel that they can't tell people about their feelings because those feelings are now functionally arrows that hurt others.
Yeah, I've had that experience with soldiers, for example. They'll almost test me to say like, hey, can I tell you this without hurting you? And they're concerned with me with their stories.
Yeah, and this gets into our confusing terminology of empathy and compassion and sympathy. And I really like the concept of compassion, which is really saying, okay, initially I have empathy, I feel this, but I have to get above this. And that getting above it is to respect your feelings without being pulled into your feelings, to honor your feelings. I don't think that's that easy for humans. We don't like to see others in pain. Mm-hmm. And I think so when we use the term super co-regulators, we can also use the word healers, because those people are coming into the presence of those with pain without absorbing the pain, but supporting the aspects of that individual's nervous system that will nullify or ameliorate their pain.
It's interesting. I mentioned it in the sponsor video. I mentioned this around Lan Stefani when I first met her. I was just like, my whole body was put at ease. And Richard Swartz is another one. I met him in California a few months ago, just ahead of the conference. And I just, with the internal family systems, Richard, just like, oh, straight away, like my whole body started, you know, just felt like, okay, we'll definitely get this guy for the conference. As soon as I met him, I thought, you know, so there's definitely a felt sense of that.
And Dick's a wonderful guy. And you met Gabor, and he's another one. I mean, these are people whose lives are dedicated to listening and trying to learn from their clients and trying to support them.
Is it just as I remember that experience of meeting Richard, my whole body's sort of glowing, actually. It's a sort of visceral body memory with a lot of joy in it, just from remembering meeting him in a hotel lobby. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, that's great.
Introverts and extroverts, someone's asking about. Are they wired differently? Do you think there's a big difference here?
Well, this is, again, a very interesting type of question, because the question is focused on a psychological construct that is really being used based upon a behavioral preference or a psychological set of preferences. Polyvagal theory basically reaches out and says these temperamental features of, or what we think are temperamental features, are often related to our autonomic state. So they may be more manipulatable than we think. So if our body goes into, in a sense, a more safer, more ventral vagal state, part of that state enables more spontaneous social engagement behaviors to occur. And if the body is in a state of, let's say, more sympathetic, more mobilized, it's going to be much more cautious and will not be as extroverted. The theories on introvert and extrovert, that, by the way, that's an English concept by Eysenck, who was a psychologist from London, from the Maudsley's, it's coming back, the Maudsley Institute, was viewed as kind of like features that carry with them a whole other set of expressions. So it was trying to look at individual differences in people and trying to categorize them in a different way. Polyvagal theory says, let's first look at autonomic regulation and look at the range of that and how that is related to the expression of both behaviors and feelings. And let's look at that first before we make the assumption that the expressions of behaviors or psychological features are hardwired in.
We had some kittens in the room earlier that someone brought in to cheer up the staff, and it was very interesting to watch them. The first 20 minutes of being in the room, they were very cautious and they hid and explored. And then after 20 minutes, they relaxed and they realized we were nice. And then they just started running around and playing with us and going crazy. And it was like a personality change, but it was that they didn't have a sense of safety.
Right. And if you had heart rate monitors on them, you would actually see their autonomic nervous system changing state from an adaptive curiosity, but a looking for signals of danger, to saying, this is safe, now let's play.
Yeah, they just relaxed, and it took about 20 minutes. It was interesting to see three of them do it. Okay, so let's have a look at the questions. Could you scan up there, Luke? There's one good one I wanna get to right at the top. Oh, that's the top. Okay. I have anxiety issues with autism and sensory overload. Joining a polyvagal support group has made a huge difference to me. What research has been done on managing autism through polyvagal theory?
Again, great questions. So I've developed an intervention called the Safe and Sound Protocol, and that uses a computer-altered vocal music, which in a sense conveys the essence of safety in auditory cues. So when people hear it, their bodies feel safer. In a way, it's an acoustic vagal nerve stimulator. And we are, in a sense, the paper is ready to be submitted in a couple of weeks, showing that if you use this with autistic individuals, their sensory profile changes, their hypersensitivities disappear, and they stay subdued, the hypersensitivities, for a month after the intervention. The intervention is 5 one-hour sessions, but what it's doing is it's, in a sense, shifting autonomic state, and when autonomic state calms down, becomes more vagal, ventral vagal, then you have more spontaneous engagement behaviors, but you also have a down regulation of hypersensitivities. auditory hypersensitivities are downregulated. The difficulty in extracting human voice is now you can hear voice better. Visual hypersensitivity, since the parasympathetic nervous system is involved in pupil dilation, that disappears. Ingestive behaviors, they become more curious about food, and gut problems start to disappear. So if you shift the physiological state of a person who carries a diagnosis of autism, many of the symptoms that have been assumed to be locked in symptoms of autism start becoming more normalized. I'm not saying you cure autism. I'm saying the symptoms that are disruptive are now greatly reduced.
Thank you. Thank you. Casey is asking about the fawning response. It might be good to define that as opposed to kind of a choiceful peacekeeping. So do you have any sense of what the fawning response is as part of your model?
Well, see, I again, there are words that start to come into the dialogue, like appeasement came in about a year ago into my talks. People start asking me that. Fawning's come in a sense, in the past year. And I think if fawning is, in a sense, giving up, just like rolling on your back, what is the physiology of that? I think it may be more in a dissociative realm, as opposed to, in a sense, feeling totally safe. So let's talk about dissociation for a moment. In polyvagal theory, if you're under life threat, there's a possibility of your body functionally shutting down, meaning you'd pass out or appear to be dead. This is potentially lethal to mammals because you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain. So the adaptive adjustment to death fainting or shutting down is dissociative, where you're maintaining blood flow to your brain and muscle tone to your limbs, but you go someplace else. So dissociation becomes an adaptive function. I think fawning is part of this cascade of, in a sense, trying to get yourself, or not, I say trying, see, I'm using intentionality words when I really am talking about reflexes that are embedded in the body. So let's say that it's the nervous system's attempt to help you survive. So fawning, just like dissociation and death feigning, are not intentional behaviors that we can recruit. They are more wired reflexes or adaptive reflex that our body will go into.
Thank you. I'm just going to shout out for Erica Chalkley, who's doing a session tomorrow called For Women Who Are Too Nice is the name of her session. And she definitely sees things in a sort of trauma-informed lens, as well as a few other lenses. Yeah. Okay. So I've got a question for you, actually, Stephen. I get asked a lot by people, I don't have any money and I need trauma help. And often people who have had trauma, they've lost jobs or they've had bashes to income, you know, right now. One of the things I'm proud about this conference is we're putting a lot of this trauma information out there. I think it's, you know, particularly in the current times. What do people do? You know, I've got a great therapist and I've had EMDR and it wasn't cheap. What do people do who can't afford some of that stuff and they find themselves, you know, with some serious trauma symptoms?
It's, you know, again, very good question, but I'm going first preface it by saying you're asking the wrong person the question, and that is, I'm not a therapist. However, all the organizations, whether you were talking about internal family systems with Dick Schwartz or somatic experience like Peter Levine, all these have some pro bono places, or some people will take some on. They're very, in a sense, culturally conscious and compassionate in organizations. They want to be helpful to others. But therapists are also human beings that need to make a living. But the other part, I'll tell you where I've been focusing on this, and that is, can I be helpful to those who experience trauma by helping them develop a different personal narrative of their own experiences? And that's where polyvagal theory has been helpful to people who have had trauma. They've read the theory and suddenly their life makes sense to them. And that making sense to them in a way is a journey towards healing. I've created the Traumatic Stress Research Consortium, which has as its goal to create a documentary, this is not a movie, but a database of what it is to be traumatized. What does it come, what comes with this package? And we're also, in a sense, surveying trauma therapists, and we're learning what works, what are the therapists saying work, and what are they trained in? And what we've learned is that most trauma therapists have been trained in eight different subspecialties. So they may be EMDR plus somatic experiencing plus internal, you know, they're out there to try to be helpful to their clients. So they learn lots of those. I've also learned from the initial surveys of therapists what the therapists think work. And this is extraordinarily interesting. They see somatic oriented therapies as being very beneficial. Cognitive oriented therapies frequently used, but not being very beneficial to trauma. So we are, in a sense, pulling the veil, pulling the curtain back to see what works and trying to share that with the trauma community. I invite trauma therapists who are online to join the consortium. Just send an email to trauma@indiana.edu and you'll get a response from my team.
Thanks, Steve. And I, you know, one thing we're trying to do to help with this is the trauma package of the different trauma teachers here. Some of it will leave free, I think, available to everyone. And also if any trauma therapists that don't have the cash right now who are working with vulnerable populations want to get a discount or even get it free from us, they can email us and get that. You know, that's one thing we're trying to put into effect to help therapists. And we're looking at different options here with the conference, and it's tricky because obviously we have to pay the bills and keep the lights on as well. Yeah. So trying to find that line.
Let me make one other point. From our surveys, we learned the motivation of trauma therapists. This is again, and the motivation of trauma therapists is far from financial. So this is the, you know, so they actually give us that information. Many of them have trauma histories themselves, and that was their motivation to become trauma therapists. But the financial reward is off the table for virtually all of them.
Yeah, and I, you know, for myself, and I know Daniela doesn't mind me saying this on behalf of her too, that it's a big motivation for us at the conference and the embodiment work, you know, our own background and work we've done in different places. It kind of, I think once you've seen that and also realize that healing is possible, I think there's a real motivation there. I know that's the case for several members of the team who have come from tricky backgrounds, to understate it horribly, that it becomes a motivation to want that to be of benefit to people.
Well, the interesting, there's interesting point in your comment, and that is what you said, tricky backgrounds. We are a traumatized species and our culture is heavily traumatized. And it's only during the past few years that people have actually feel empowered to talk about it. And I mean, there are stories that you hear that you would never have guessed, because most of us grew up with the notion of superficial or surface variables as being the defining features: attractiveness, cars in the driveway, houses, degrees, how much money you make, those things. And what we realize, especially those who are in this trauma world, where we learn from people who appear to be successful but have trauma histories, is that that's not what they want. They want relationships. They want connectedness. And this brings us back to our earlier comments. They want to be embodied so that they can be in a co-regulatory state with others.
I wonder if they were in the last sort of 5 minutes here, if there's can something on hope here, in that for the first time in human history, the species is learning about trauma. I mean, like, you know, 500,000 people, it's not nothing, 500,000 people at this conference, in terms of, you know, over half of them have already seen a session. The trauma ones are the most popular. They'll be affecting another 10, 20 million people. Yeah. I mean, we've got people in Russia, Saudi Arabia, people all over the world are part of this event. And it feels hopeful, even against the backdrop of politics and COVID and everything else. It feels deeply hopeful.
Yeah, I really like to respond to the optimistic aspect of not just the embodiment conference, but also in terms of polyvagal theory. Polyvagal theory is a theory of optimism because it says if we understand the mechanisms and we understand the portals to re-energize or retune, that autonomic nervous system, our experience in living can be optimized, that we can rehabilitate, we can optimize the human experience. I used to use the phrase, what is the goal of all this? And I would say it's to optimize the human experience, because what we're learning from the world of trauma is the lives of so many people have been, in a sense, limited by their trauma history. And from a polyvagal perspective, that's really saying is that their trauma history has retuned their autonomic nervous system to keep them alive and to be defensive. But if we give the cues of safety and the context is safe, that autonomic nervous system can be retuned with the product of becoming a more spontaneously socially engaging individual capable of co-regulating with others.
This relates to a question here in the chat as well, that do you think the current context of sort of unsafety around health or politics, or, you know, there's a few, but they're two big ones, can lead to old traumas coming up, or, you know, or is it the opposite? Does it give us this opportunity to actually to look at things? What's your take on how the current impact?
This is just like the difference between empathy and compassion. Are the cues triggering feelings that are similar or uncovering our reactions of defense? Or are we, in a sense, seeing it and then having a sufficient sense of self that we see vulnerabilities without falling into those vulnerabilities? I think it's varied. I think we have to first understand that we can have interventions on ourselves which stabilize our physiological state to make us more resilient. And with that resilience, we can then become more compassionate. So I'm going to flip this totally around and say, what is embodiment to me? Embodiment to me is when the nervous system is doing its job and regulating our visceral organs through homeostatic processes, and we're not in a state of defense reacting to threat. And then there's, with embodiment, there's the unfolding of what it is to be a human, which has all these wonderful emergent properties of co-regulating, engaging others, and also traveling to different parts of our brain to do creative intellectual work. So it's not like I'm all in the body, there's no intellect. I'm saying if my body is safe, wow, look at all the intellectual things I can do because I don't have to be concerned about being hurt.
So much here, Stephen. It's super rich and I've loved it as ever. Maybe lastly then, people out there with trauma, maybe suffering, you know, we do hear about this, meet people in the conference. What would be your message to them if somebody's, you know, really suffering, maybe sleep disturbances or addiction issues related to trauma? What would you say to them?
Well, the first thing is, what I normally hear when we get all these issues, one, there's a trauma history. And number two, there's a series of common, let's use the term, medically unexplained symptoms. So it's not merely they feel better not sleeping. They have irritable bowel, fibromyalgia. They have a lot of autonomic, atypical autonomic regulations. I would basically say, let us talk about the script that you're in. Your body is in a state of threat and defense, and that is what is going on. You don't have the disease that they're, in a sense, trying to label themselves as having, whether it's a mental health disease or comorbid physical health. The primary thing we want to tell them is your nervous system is reacting to the world as if the world is dangerous and has moved you into physiological states that are very adaptive for the short term. When you're under threat. But when you're in this state chronically, it starts interfering with the nervous system's capacity to regulate the organs in your body, meaning that the progression, disruption of this neural homeostatic function will result in end organ damage. And it's the end organ damage that brings people into internal medicine, into surgery, and into disease labeling. But the nervous system regulation of the organ, if it gets disrupted, basically puts that individual on a trajectory of chronic disease. So what I'm trying to say is the narrative is that if your body is in a state of threat, the body is going to do what it can do, and it does that at great expense. And the great expense is to monitor and serve the health growth and restoration functions of your organs.
Stephen, pleasure and wonderful as ever. In terms of finding out more in you and your work, where should people head to?
Oh, they can go to my webpage, which is stephenporges.com. And in a few weeks, we'll have a new webpage called Polyvagal Institute, where people can go to get more information on educational offerings in polyvagal theory.
And we'll definitely help you put your stuff out there in the future, Stephen. It's appreciated. We want to see it known widely in the world, even more than it is already.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate you inviting me and spending an hour with me on the main stage.
Pleasure. Feels like you're in the living room here. But yeah. If people want a bit of co-regulation, they can go to the breakout rooms. If you haven't used those already, the coffee breaks are one of the top features of the whole conference. You don't have to bring coffee. You can bring herbal tea or no beverage at all. It's just a nice way to chat to other people and have a little bit more of that backwards and forwards than you will get, you know, listening to an interview or a lecture. Facebook, actually, our Facebook is relatively benign and pleasant. Compared to some social media, I think largely due to Rosie and the team. So if you want to go there and discuss any of these issues, you're welcome. And of course, there's been loads of sessions that you are now in the library. So Gabor Mate, Peter Levine, Richard Swartz, there's been so many good trauma sessions. The library is double after the conference. The price of it doubles. It's half price right now, well worth getting if you can. We're on the home straight to break even point. So I personally appreciate it as well. I will no longer be stressed when I call my accountant or bank manager. We're getting there. So thank you everyone for that support. If you can't afford it, I understand that. And if you can, you know, there's a great library there if you can access it. Daniela, anything you want to add to this before we wrap up?
I'm delighted to listen to Stephen again, and that's again one of the talks I will need to re-listen with a little bit more headspace after the conference. So thank you.
Thank you. So we always go back, Stephen, to the speaker for the final word, and we're going to put a top tip or a single sentence quote from every presenter into a book. So what would you like yours to be, sir?
Well, okay, let's see where we go with this one. Basically, listen to your body. And as you listen to your body tells you whether you're in a world of safety and trust or you're in a world of threat. And if you get cues of threat, take a deep breath and see if you can exhale slowly and calm yourself down. And then does the world look more pleasant to you?
Stephen Porges, thank you very much for joining us at the Embodiment Conference. Thank you. I'll see you again, sir.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Danielle. Bye-bye.